All right, Judges chapter 17. I'll tell you up front, most people agree. I think everybody that matters as far as biblical scholarship agree this is not in chronological order, okay? I know when I was a young Christian, that used to really freak me out. It shouldn't. It's just the order. And what I mean by that is what we're about to read tonight, and I don't think we'll get into 18 because it's me. I want to, but I don't think we will. But I do think that it's easy for us to think that this comes right after Samson, right? Samson was a judge there in Israel, a bad judge, or a less than perfect judge from my perspective, did a lot wrong, filled with compromise. And what we will see tonight is this man by the name of Micah. There's no judge mentioned at all, actually, in chapter 17. And most scholars agree, once again, that this probably took place just after the arrival of the people of Israel in the land of Israel. So this would have been shortly after Joshua's time, actually. Very shortly after Joshua died, and very quickly the people of Israel began to give their hearts over to idolatry. They compromised, all kinds of sexual sin. We'll see some of that tonight. So let's begin. Chapter 17, verse 1, and there was a man of Mount Ephraim whose name was Micah. So far, so good, right? You know, his name means one like God. What a title. And you think about his mom and his dad, you know, freshly into the promised land. They finally arrived to the land flowing with milk and honey. They have a child, and they're going to name him, you know, God-like or one like God. And no doubt they had a heart behind that name. I think parents name their children with every good intention, right? At least I think so. Sometimes you hear names and you think, man, how could you mean anything but cruelty behind that? But you didn't come here for that. But Micah, I mean, you know, to be like God, what a call on this young man's life. He was from Mount Ephraim. He was from the tribe of Ephraim. This is Joseph's stock. They have some serious legacy and serious history. Their, you know, patriarch, Joseph, talk about a man who was determined not to compromise and sacrifice his faith in the midst of all kinds of temptation and adversity. And Joseph was the type of guy where you read about him and think, man, what a man of integrity. When nobody else was around and nobody would know, he says, but God would. That's integrity, by the way. If we're just trying to paint the outside to make it look good for every human that sees it, that's hypocrisy. But to live in such a way where you are above reproach and obedient to the Lord when nobody else is around, that's Joseph. Joseph was an incredible man. A man, yes, but an incredible one. This is his ancestor. So Micah comes from really good stock, but here we go in verse 2. He said unto his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursed, and spake of also that in my ears, behold, the silver is with me, I took it. Yikes. 1,100 pieces of silver. By the way, you're going to see in this chapter before it's over, 10 shekels of silver were an annual wage in this time, okay? 10 shekels of silver would be a good labor's wage. This woman has over 100 years of money stockpiled, probably her and her husband's life savings. The husband's not mentioned, he's probably gone. 1,100 pieces of silver go missing. Over 100 years of life's concerning. you'd curse too, right? You'd curse. And this lady is out loud so that her son in the next room can hear. She's kind of talking to God. No doubt there's a lot of passion. There's a lot of bitterness in this. And she says, whoever took this money, curse him, God. Curse him from the day he was ever born. May 1,000 fleas wind up in his underpants. You know, Jews are very elaborate with their cursings. They really are. So imagine being in the next room and you're hearing that from your mom, from your mommy, calling down curses on you, and you know that 1,100 shekels of silver is in your sock drawer. Ding, 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 ding. You know, you can hear it every time you walk in your room and the floor bounces. Well, he swallows hard, and you might think this is very commendable, and I think there's a piece here that is, but just doesn't fit the rest of his character. He goes up to his mom and he says, you know, Mom, the 1,100 pieces of silver, you know the ones. I was listening to you pray this morning and you were talking about whoever took that, let him be cursed. I did it. I have the 1,100 pieces of silver. And look how Mom responds. Look how Mom responds, like a typical mom. Blessed be thou of the Lord, my son. What? Soft. If nothing else, you got to say that this mom's a little soft. Maybe that had something to do with why he thought he should take it or could take it and get away with it. But she immediately, you know, revokes her curse and she asks a blessing on her son. Good for her son? Would that be a good life lesson? Probably not, right? Probably not. In fact, more than just revoking the curse and now asking the Lord, I meant bless. More than that, she's actually inclined to give it to him prematurely. Let's read this. It's a little bit bizarre, actually, but look at verse 11. When he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son, to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will restore it to you. So Mom kind of discloses her plan. Maybe it was her will, and just, you know, Micah thought he'd get his hands on it a little bit prematurely. But she says, Micah, I'll tell you up front, I had plans for that money, and it was actually to give it to you anyway, so that you could go out and purchase all those idols that I know you like so much. And come to find out, he's a collector of idols. He already has a handful of them. And Mom, a Jewish lady from the tribe of Ephraim, you know, knows probably, if the scholars are right, I'm no scholar, but if the scholars are right, probably knew firsthand Joshua, who led them into the land, knows about the patriarch Joseph, whose tribe she belongs to. Instead of rebuking her son for having this little hobby on the side, a room all dedicated to these idols, instead of rebuking him, she's enabling him. She's encouraging this. I really do believe this is one of the biggest problems with our nation right now. And I know that's a radical statement, but I've sat in a lot of meetings, you know, with the Arise program early on. I've sat with a lot of law enforcement. You know, the problems are, you know, always come down to money. You know, here in Washington County, we just don't get the money flow that the state of Maine contributes everywhere else. I don't think it's a money issue at all. God provides. God provides for ministries, and he always has. And, you know, the truth is that's never been the issue here, money. Even a little poor country church like we are, we have a surplus of resources. That's not the problem. But when we look at this, you know, epidemic of addiction and overdose death, it's the scourge of our society. It's the scourge of our nation right now. It really is. But as you get involved in people's lives, there is a common denominator. There's a common denominator, and it is rearing. It is the way an individual's been reared. It's the way a parent either enabled and sadly, and I've used the term before, loved that child to death, quite literally, or gave that child some very necessary discipline along the way. I mean godly and good discipline. I'm not talking about abuse. That's the other side of the coin, of course. That's the other side of the coin. But good and godly discipline. I've said it 1,000 times, and I don't want to make it about me at all, but I am grateful to my mother who looked at me at 14 years of age and said, get out of my house. You're no longer welcome here. I don't know if you can even legally do that anymore. I don't think she would have cared, truthfully. She said, get out of my house, with tears in her eyes, by the way. 14, I was not yet 15, almost. And I hit the streets. And I didn't come back home until I was married. I guess I never came back home, because that would be weird. But I got married. I never returned home. I just started my life at 18. I started young. And I absolutely believe that it's because of that position that my mom took, I didn't end up being involved in addiction for 10 and 20 and 30 years, like I see very common. I had the heart to, by the way. I had the stubbornness to. I had the sin lust to. But I experienced consequences early on. I felt the weight of the world. My mom didn't pad any blows. She let things fall. and crash and burn all around me. I'm very thankful for that. This is a mom here that just doesn't understand how vital it is to mete out discipline. Now, granted, her son might be an older man. He actually has children at this point. But again, this is I think this is an ongoing issue probably in this family, and I think this family screams of dysfunction personally. But I was going to give that to you anyway. Here, let me go ahead and give it right back. Well, let's push forward. Yet he restored the money unto his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the founder, and made thereof a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. Oh, that's very interesting. You know, you speak pretty dramatically when your heart's involved. She got her money back. She's excited. She loves her son. She feels bad about the curse. He probably had a few crocodile tears. So she promises him the moon. I was going to give all that to you. No, Mom, I insist. Take it back. And then she's like, well, like 200. It's just interesting. Like, where'd the other 900 go? But she takes 200 shekels. Apparently, she did want it for herself, so it seems. And she just walks out the door, so it seems, and walks down the block and just hands it to an idol carver and puts her order in. I'd like one of these. I want it to look like this. I want it to be completely, you know, wrapped in silver, overlaid in silver, and I want it by Tuesday. And she gets it. And why I'm bringing it up and presenting it so nonchalant, this is Israel, brothers and sisters. This is Israel. This is a place that is set apart, unique unto God. This is God's people, where he very strictly forbid, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's the first commandment. They're very privy to that commandment at this point, by the way. Moses has come and gone. Joshua has come and gone. They know the law. And it seems like it was very, very easy to just walk down the street and throw some money across the counter and get yourself a pagan deity, a wooden doll overlaid in silver that you can worship and offer to. The accessibility of sin, the convenience of sin. You know, a culture is at the brink of judgment when sin is at our fingertips. Do you understand that? When sin is so accessible, like you just walk out the street and get anything you want, pursue anything you want, or worse than that, we can lay in our beds, right? Or draw our shades and just dial it up in our world today. The most vile and debauched sin is literally made, thanks Satan, so accessible to us. You know, these smartphones that we all carry around, I do wonder sometimes, guys, I do wonder if it has been the biggest thorn in the church's side. I really wonder. As convenient as it's made ministry, I like to text as much as the next guy. I really do, because there's times when you call somebody, you see their name, and you take the deep breath, like, that's 20 minutes all day. And you're like, I just don't have 20 minutes. And then you can, I love being able to say, see you tomorrow. Love you. I just love that, personally. I hope that doesn't sound jaded or cynical. Maybe it is, but I'm just being honest. It's really nice to fire off a quick text and have some very quick and brief communication. But we've created a monster, too, I think. I think we've created a false understanding of the accessibility of pastors and people. Can you imagine? Just rewind the clock like 40, 50 years. Can you imagine? You know where the pastor lives. He lives in that house over there on the other side of town. You got to drive there. Hope he's home. If he's not home, you'd have to leave a note on his door, right? And say, you know, I have a crisis, or I have a marriage need, or could you please do this funeral or a wedding? And at your earliest convenience, could you respond? And, you know, in a week or so, he'd probably get on his horse and come to your house and say, oh, by the way, I'd never marry you and your, you know, whatever he would say. I'm just kidding. But can you imagine, you know, that's the way the world was, and it was very acceptable, and a man would serve his community, but not like we have created. It's almost like ministry on steroids. And some of it's unnatural, right? Some of it's just not the way it was supposed to be. And you got pastors that feel like they need to be a hero and respond to every text that comes to their phone within 30 seconds or less. I'm not saying that if you messaged me recently and didn't get a response, that's not damage control, but I'm just serious. We have such convenience in our world. Has it benefited in revival? Is the church revived? No. You ask your own self, has it resulted in your life in personal, spiritual holiness, a greater degree of love and passion for Christ? Has it? Has the modern age contributed to that? We've communicated better. We got good communication. Thank God for that. I do love to be able to sit down and be able to talk to Eric Beeler in Nepal. What a cool thing, right? There's advantages to it, for sure. But if we did a list and we looked at the pros and the cons, I think the cons might win. Well, brothers and sisters, this lady just goes out and buys an idol for her kid. And by the way, there's a lot of people that would suggest that the idols of that day were very anatomically correct and very suggestive. You probably know that, right? You're the Wednesday night crowd. This is the ancient form of pornography. That brings a little bit different twist when mom is buying it for your son, truthfully. It brings a little bit of a different spin on this whole thing. This is a description of a culture that has just absolutely abandoned absolutes, truth, morality. And unfortunately, this sounds more and more like the world that you and I live in. Just listening to the news and listening to people respond with such unbelievable hatred because of the reversal of the Roe v. Wade. It blows my mind, actually. It blows my mind. Like, you're out there rallying this aggressively, and small pockets of violence have even broken out in our country because you want it to be okay to kill children in the womb that bad. That's where our culture is at. And I'm telling you, the less than 1% scenario where, you know, a tubal pregnancy is the situation, or if it is a rape situation, those are really, really small. We do understand that, right? You can reason with people logically. Rape is horrible, but we should never make policies and laws and principles based on the emotion that a horrible crime creates in your heart. Right and wrong still matter, even if a horrible crime takes place, right? And like we've always said, and like I actually believe this. I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that two rights or two wrongs don't make a right. That's the truth. This is the world you and I live in. Mothers are contributing. Let me just say one more thought to that. I remember in high school, living on my own, living on couches and begging people to let me in. And, if you've been there, the couch surfing world, you remember. We always wanted to find a mom that was more like a buddy than a mom. Or we always wanted to find a dad that was more like a buddy than a dad. He would facilitate or she would facilitate the party. Now, you kids don't breathe a word of this, but some insecure need, apparently, in this mom or this dad, they'd throw the party. They'd furnish the party. And they'd participate, which gets weird, quite frankly. And a lot of bad and sin happens in the state of Maine because of the adult involvement in, teenager affairs. And many of us know that very well, don't we? We understand that. Worse than that, school teachers. I was a groomer from way back. I could figure out who a teacher was and, use that to my advantage. And I'm not going to risk saying names in case they still are employed, but there were school teachers in my life that I spent a lot of time after school with, smoking and doing drugs, snorting pills and drinking alcohol. School teachers, they're supposed to be the heroes. They're supposed to be the model. It's a joke, truthfully, behind the scenes. And what mom and dad don't know, they find out when they're sons are in their 30s and say, Mom, did you ever figure this out? My poor mom's been horrified since we've been adult kids. What? That teacher? Oh, yeah, that teacher. That's the real world, right? That's the world we live in. Yeah. Well, since being naive to it, well, look at this. It says in verse 5 that the man Micah had a house of gods. How do you like that? A whole house, a whole little temple of his own, filled with idols. He made an ephod. You know what that is? That is the priestly garment. He has no business making that. That was an outfit that was consecrated and unique only to the priest. This was a capital offense, actually. He made himself a priestly garment. And teraphim, that's a whole collection of idols, by the way. Im in Hebrew makes it plural. These are little figurines that he would worship. He could even rent them out, actually. He consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Isn't that interesting? He needed a priest. He needed a mediator. He's involving his own son in his sin. He went through a ceremony and ordained one of his sons to be a pagan priest, to mediate, to talk to God and talk to God for him, to potentially sacrifice. All that happened in this home. This is a very occult-like situation here. And it tells us in verse 6, which kind of opens our eyes a little bit to what's going on. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Relativism. That's the most popular religion in America right now, unfortunately. It's growing. Evangelical Christianity is down, secularism is up. And the most popular religion in America right now is secular humanism, kind of shrouded in what we call relativism. There is no absolute truth. If it's true for you, then it's true. But I have my own personal truth. There literally are people with credentials, by the way, that have hijacked truth. They've stolen it, or so they think, right? And they've made truth their own personal, you know, doll or servant. It doesn't work like that. They will answer to the truth. They will, like Pontius Pilate, one day stand before the truth personified. And they won't say in that great white throne scenario, they won't say, what is truth? They'll say, Jesus is Lord, and they'll bow the knee. We're told that in the scriptures. But relativism, brothers and sisters, is on the loose, and it really is described well here. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. He's his own authority. Whatever he drums up in his evil heart, that becomes his code, his conduct, his statement of faith. Is that a good thing? You know, let me say this to my American citizens. Liberty is not doing what is right in your own eyes. You don't think that, do you? Surely you on Wednesday night don't think that. True freedom means I can do anything that I want whenever I want to do it. Surely you haven't drank that Kool-Aid and bought that lie. But true liberty is the right to do the right thing. And there's no repercussions, right? To worship Christ how I want to and how the scriptures teach us to, without any repercussions of persecution. To go out there and voice my opinion and reason with people. To give to the poor. To work hard and have something to show for it. That's freedom, brothers and sisters. Freedom is not a selfish thing. I've said this for years. The same people that believed enough in liberty that they were willing to die and fight for it, they drafted the Declaration of Independence, signed off with this, we will give our life, our liberty, and our sacred honor. Right? We'll put everything we have. We will die with this. That wasn't a selfish pursuit then. If they were willing to give everything in terms of their resources, their life, even their reputation of being criminals, their sacred honor, certainly liberty to them didn't mean, oh, the goodies I'm going to get. It didn't. It's important that we understand that. These people, this culture, did what was right in their own eyes. What's the difference? What should we contrast with that? And I'm not trying to be confusing. What's a better way to live, guys? Not to do what's right in your own eyes. You're going to get yourself in trouble, and so would I every time. What's a better way to live? Okay, to keep our eyes, but even more specifically, to do what it is right in his eyes. He's watching. That's the point. He's watching. He's omnipresent. And I've said this for a long time. If you struggle with besetting sin this evening, your problem is not financial. It's not psychological. It is theological. If you really believe that God is everywhere at the same time and he's watching your life, he sees you when nobody else is around, and that's the one you will stand before in the end, your problem is theological. You don't really believe that. You can't really believe that. I can't really believe and fear the Lord if I flaunt my sin right in his presence, knowing better. Something's off there. I got a theological problem. It's better for us to fear the Lord, church, and to always be reminded in a very gracious and loving way. He's overseeing, he's watching. It's very, you're his children, don't forget that. He's not watching. It's not that old song I used to sing as a kid. There's a father up above who will squash you like a bug, so be careful, little. I kind of had that mindset about God, tragically. I did. I had this mindset of God that any day now, man, the ceiling's going to fall in on Aaron Dudley. Lived in that, and that's probably why I pursued drugs so much, because I wanted to shut that off. Backslidden church kids go the hardest. Because that noise, that Holy Spirit going, where are you going, you little twerp? You know, and you're trying to shut that off, right? Well, some of you are laughing, you must remember. Look at verse 7. And there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. And he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city from Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn where he could find a place. And he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah. As he journeyed. So he's from Bethlehem, Judah. Remember, the Levites didn't have something that all the other tribes had. What was that, guys? Shout it out. They didn't have their own land. They didn't have their own law or inheritance. Their inheritance was the Lord. Pretty cool. So what you have as you study the Bible in the Old Testament, you have Levites kind of scattered by God's design throughout every tribe. There's pockets of Levites everywhere so that the spiritual leaders of the nation would be accessible. It's genius, actually. It's all about accessibility. Going back on my smartphone spiel. This particular Levite has had enough of meager living. And in his defense, because there's so much idolatry in the land and sin in the land, probably people weren't coming to the temple and offering sacrifices. Probably people weren't tithing. So the Levites, and this happened many times throughout Israel's history, the Levites are starving. You know, and I don't want to say this. I think it's okay to say this. I'm looking around. I don't see any super young people. Nope, we're good. She's got headphones on. You know, third world prostitution is much different than first world prostitution. You know that, right? Third world prostitution is very often the only option in many of these young ladies' minds. And it's something that they choose to do because it's that or starvation in many cases. And of course, that's horrible and it's exploited. But why I bring that up is because there are Levites that compromise. They go deep into sin and into the world as you study the Old Testament. And in some ways, it's they're victims of the sin of their culture, and they're kind of forced into prostituting themselves, spiritually speaking. That's exactly what this priest is doing. He's literally combing the land, looking for a place, as a priest, where he can get a gig. That's what he's doing. He's looking for opportunity, which is extremely sad. And he finds himself at this very idolatrous little mini pagan temple owned by this man, Micah. And let's look what happens here. In verse 9, it says, "And Micah said unto him, Whence comest thou?" Hope that's okay. It's my old Bible. "Where you come from?" And he said, "I'm a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn where I might find a place." Kind of throwing out some applications, looking for a place to work and to serve. "And Micah said unto him, Dwell with me. And be unto me a father and a priest, and I will give thee," notice, 10 shekels of silver by the year, and a suit of apparel, and thy victuals," or thy victuals. So the Levite went in. I don't know if we realize how tragic that is, what we just read. "Oh man, great to meet you. I'll tell you what, stay here. I'll employ you. I'll give you an annual wage. I'll give you a really nice shirt." That's literally what this suit of apparel, it's a really nice shirt. "And I'll take care of your room and board. You know, you can eat here, you can sleep here." And that's not so bad. That's not so bad. But what's bad is, it says, "And the Levite went in." He literally sold everything that was sacred. sold out on the Lord, sold out on his responsibility, betrayed his nation for 10 shekels and a shirt and some potentially good food, a place to lay his head. That's a tragedy, brothers and sisters. That's an absolute tragedy. This man turns his back on his calling for temporary security in earthly things. Now, let's stew on that for a moment. Let's just think about that for a moment. He turned his back on his calling for temporary earthly security and a nice shirt. Probably fashionable. Is that okay? Is that reasonable? I mean, after all, he might have been pretty lean. It was rough times there in the temple, tabernacle at that point. Is it reasonable? You know, I can't help but think about Judas. You know, Judas betrayed Jesus himself for pieces of silver, you know? And as soon as he got them in his hand, as soon as he did the deed, just plagued with condemnation and guilt, returns back and throws it all on the floor. He essentially betrayed Jesus for no money at all, just a condemning suicide end, truthfully. What's going on with this Levite? Could it be that this Levite suffers from something that I think I see in this culture? I've seen it in my own heart. I want to share something with you tonight. Could it be that this Levite suffers from a completely wrong idea about a relationship with God? Now, you guys know we're not prosperity teachers around here. I would never suggest, you know, that you know, Jesus, if your faith is intact, you know, and walking with Jesus, you should never be sick and you should always be wealthy and, you know, all these miracles should have. That's the prosperity gospel. That's the prosperity. And I think everybody in this room, as I'm looking around the room, I pretty much know everybody. None of you have bought that seed sowing faith and, you know, 100-fold increase on your tithing. We don't teach that around here. We don't even believe in tithing. We don't think there's a New Testament tax. The only requirement for giving in the entire New Testament is just do it with a smile, basically. Be cheerful. So if you can't give cheerful, you should probably keep it. God doesn't need our money. That's the truth. He provides, but he doesn't need our resources. So I think that's a gross balance issue. But at the same time, even though you don't believe in the prosperity gospel, you believe sometimes people get sick and it is according to God's will. You believe sometimes people suffer and go through things and God isn't going to wipe it away based on if your faith is just so or you claim it or say the right words. But what about just wanting him to bless your life in a very reasonable in generic way? For example, what if your sin has compromised your marriage and has put you at odds with your wife, estranged you from your children? Did you come to Jesus assuming he's going to make all of that better and restore this and make the whole family come back and giggle together again? Did you come to Jesus because, you know, you're under the persuasion that, you know, it's just a healthier life and certainly there's blessings in it? Did you come to Jesus for the sole purpose that you're scared of hell and you want to go to heaven? And Jesus to you is just, you know, it's definitely future heaven. And this, I want to go to heaven really bad. Don't misunderstand me. I won't speed up the process, I promise, but I want to go there really bad. I long to be with my Lord. I really do. This world's got nothing for me, and that's true more and more every single day, right? But I want to challenge a motive that's very common. And that's just this, brothers and sisters. There are a lot of people in church that look at God as a means to an end instead of the end itself. In other words, I'm going to include you in my life, God. I'm going to include your life in all this disaster and all this hurt, all this stuff that I've dealt with, even my emotional struggles. Surely you're a solution to it. But the day you abandon me, the day it doesn't pan out like I expected it to, I'm out of here. And tragically, that happens a lot. I read something in the scriptures that disturbs me. It's like this. It goes, in the last days, many will depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. What is that? What is it that the scriptures describe? What's wrong with the church so that in the last days many are going to leave the faith. Is it even a little bit of a wrong understanding that God, you love me, you're in my life, and therefore everything's always going to be okay? Christians starve to death, brothers and sisters, outside of America. Christians get burned at the stake. They get pinned to crosses. They get persecuted and killed. We have known, by the grace of God, 250, almost 300 years of persecution-free faith here in America. And I believe by God's design, because of that, we have been the largest nation in church history as far as sending missionaries all over the world. But that's becoming a has-been statistic, unfortunately. Ask yourself this question, just to make it clear. Ask yourself this question. Are you tonight using God to accomplish what you hope is a better life here? Is that what this is all about? Is God to you your means to accomplish the best life here on earth, having maybe visited some dark chapters of your life? Or, and I believe the better alternative is, are you allowing God to use you to accomplish his purposes with your life? Do you understand the difference? Because it's a heaven or hell difference, I believe. I really believe that. Are you using God to accomplish what you hope is a better life here? Did you come to God hoping that he's just going to fix everything and make things better? Or do you come to God because you are convinced he is worthy of my life? He deserves my obedience. He's deserving of all of me. That's a proper motive, church. And I really believe this priest is combing the world, looking for, with his God talk, a better scenario here on earth. And he found one, tragically. And he took it quickly. He took it very quickly. It's not just him. It's not just him. You'll actually see that same motive, that same wrong thinking in Micah as well. The Levite went in, tragic, tragic. He abandoned a lot for such a little price. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man was unto him as a son, one of his sons. So this Levite becomes part of the family. Does that make it okay? Oh, we're really close. We let him do what he wants. A lot of times we compromise. I've seen it. I've seen compromise in the name of, well, he's part of the family. He's kind. It's great. Emotion should not play in on right or wrong once again. And then look at this. Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Then said Micah, now I know that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest. You see, there it is again. Micah was under the same persuasion as the Levite. Now I know God will do me good because I have a legit Levite as a priest. So certainly you would agree that Micah viewed God and whatever we do to keep God happy as a means to favor and blessing and a better life here on earth. It's wrong thinking, church. It's wrong thinking. You know, having prayed for the church recently, praying for our church recently, just thinking about real revival. And I've been worried about this for years, maybe 2 or 3 years. I guess since COVID, really, I started to have this horrible pit in my gut that people that I love, people that go to this church, when and if things really fall apart for this country economically, they'll stop coming and they'll walk away from the Lord. And they'll, if nothing else, they'll just come to the conclusion that maybe God failed us. And it's sad, you know, it's sad to think about. And I hope that that never happens. I trust that it won't. I'm determined to preach and to share God's word and try to condition us for the worst. I do think that's proper pastoral ministry right now. I don't want to sound like a bummer all the time, but we know that it gets worse before it gets better, right? We're reading all the same book, so, you know, as things fall apart and as people abandoning the faith, and, you know, it says in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that in the last days, perilous times will come. dangerous times. Why? Because men will be lovers of their own self. This self-love, self-esteem, narcissistic culture that we've created that cares so much about themselves, they'll go to school and shoot their classmates and their teachers. That's a dangerous environment. I get concerned as we move in that direction. Is the church ready for a season of suffering? We've been so well taken care of. We've been overfed in every way, spiritually and otherwise. Could we go into a season where we're making fires out in the woods? And I'm not trying to be dramatic. I'm not. Could we go into a season where we're eating porcupines and beaver meat? You know? It's really not that bad. I don't know if you've ever had beaver. It's actually, I would order beaver on a menu. Troy and I, one time, were blessed with beaver, backstrap beaver. And we were visiting. And we prepared it right in the back room. And as we're talking, we started eating it. And we looked at each other, and our eyes got really big, and we thought, this is exceptional. So, good news. Good news. We got a lot of rodents around here. We'll be just fine. But would that be okay with you, brothers and sisters? Would it be okay with you if everything you have, earthly speaking, is gone tomorrow, but you still had your Lord Jesus? Would you come to the conclusion that Jesus failed? Or would you come to the conclusion, oh, dear Lord, I need you more than ever. Show yourself strong. This could be our greatest opportunity to show the world what faith really looks like. We haven't really had that opportunity much, truthfully. I hope that doesn't sound mean and bully-like, but we really haven't had a chance to show the world in terms of demonstrating this is what faith looks like. This is what it means to trust the Lord at all costs. And we very well could. We very well could have that opportunity. Let's pray. Do we have a song to close with? Can we make one up? All right, let's stand, church, and go out of here with a prayer and a song. Father, thank you so much for your word this evening. And Lord, I pray for my life that I wouldn't be a baby and spleeny and cave and abandon you and compromise my faith because I have had expectations about you that aren't realistic. The truth is, Lord, there isn't one thing, not even one thing you could do in my life that would supersede or top what you have already done, which is dying for my sins, shedding your precious blood for me, and inviting me to be your son. There's nothing you could do, Lord, that would top that. I'm content. I'm grateful for that, Lord. Anything beyond that is extra. It's a blessing. And Lord, I just pray that this evening as we worship you, as we sing this last song, that there would be a pledge of allegiance to you in our heart all over again, a dedication to you. And we could say to you, Lord, the groom, as your bride, more than our earthly weddings, for richer, for poorer, sickness and in health, till death do us part, Lord. May we be able to say that to you sincerely this evening. In Jesus' name, amen.